Well, hi, everyone. Welcome to this edition of the Catholic Connect podcast on another beautiful day that the Lord has made. Quote, there is no evil to be faced that Christ does not face with us. There is no enemy that Christ has not already conquered. There is no cross to bear that Christ has not already borne for us and does not now bear with us. End quote. From the great Saint John Paul II. You know, one of so many quotes and so many inspirational writings of St. John Paul II. I can only imagine what it'd be like right now. Can you imagine? He went to, I believe, over 100 countries. I know he was in Canada a few times. He was in Edmonton when I was two. I got very close to him. But I was quite young, so I didn't quite appreciate that opportunity as much as I would today. But just such an amazing example of holiness. And though not perfect, for sure, as anybody that's human, any pope is not perfect. But really, the Pope for that time, he came at the right time, and his influence, especially what he did in the war, that battle to fight communism and Marxism, that's something that we can take those notes and apply today, because our world is full of Marxist sympathizers and communists and enemies of the church. Let's just keep it real and call it for what it is. So I was really happy to track down Patrick Novakovsky. From Saskatchewan originally. All the cool guys come from Saskatchewan. I don't know if that's what you've noticed or not, cool guys and cool girls. But it was so neat to catch up with Patrick and his ministry. He wrote a great book about the life of St. John Paul II, and he's doing some other great work in the church right now. So we're going to talk about that in this episode and in this interview. And I want to wish a happy new year to everyone. We are in 2022, and again, this is a time for us to say, what can we do in our spiritual lives? What is our resolution that we have got to make and we have got to follow through on this year? And I know that that's something that you can't sometimes make just one decision that's all-encompassing that's going to cover you for a year. But it's got to be an ongoing decision to walk with Jesus Christ in a state of grace, live the sacramental life, and see what Jesus is calling you to in your state of life. Most of us are married, we have families, we have kids, maybe we have grandkids. We work in the world, but we're not of the world. But there is something that we're all called to do, to bring and to build this kingdom of Jesus Christ. And on this journey, it's not easy, but rest assured, there's a lot of people that are in the exact same boat as you are on this journey. We're going to do this together, and that's why I'm so excited for 2022. Whatever challenges that come our way, we know our Lord Jesus Christ is with us, and we have a lot of great players on this team. So without further ado, very happy and very blessed to introduce you to Patrick Novakovsky. Speaking of good guys on our team right now, and we're going to talk a little bit about the life of St. John Paul II and some of the good work that Patrick is doing right now. We'll see you on the other side, my friends.
My name is Christopher. You're listening to the Catholic Canuck podcast with my dad.
Praise be Jesus Christ, now and forever. Well, it's a great blessing to have this gentleman join our podcast. Born and raised in Saskatchewan, so I already like him, and I'm sure our listeners already like him because he's from Saskatchewan. He's an international speaker, author of a fantastic book called 100 Ways That John Paul II Changed the World, and he's a managing partner at Nova Media, which is a marketing and communications firm for Catholic organizations. Most importantly, he's a family man and our brother in Christ. Welcome, Patrick Novakovsky, to the podcast. Welcome, Patrick.
Great to be with you, David.
Well, that's awesome. I'm really glad that we got to catch up with each other. And I was telling you a little bit offline that somehow we managed to connect on Facebook. And I saw a picture of you with your son, and he has a hat with the S on it of Saskatchewan Rough Riders. And I didn't know much about your background at the time, Patrick, but I said, there's got to be a story behind this. So found out that you are from Saskatchewan, and obviously from those humble beginnings on the prairies, the Lord has taken you to all kinds of on some great adventures. So maybe start with us there, Patrick, with where your humble beginnings and how you got to where you are today.
Well, interesting you should put it that way, because I have Humboldt beginnings.
Humboldt, Saskatchewan. That's right.
Born and raised in Humboldt, Saskatchewan. So I come from a Humboldt background. my parents raised me and my eight siblings on a farm just south of Humboldt in a little town called Burr, on a farm near Burr. As a matter of fact, 5 miles south of Burr on Highway 20. And yeah, I just grew up in the prairies and, you know, the cold winters of Saskatchewan and the beautiful summers. And My dad was a diehard Rough Riders fan, and that sank deep into my bones, and I carried that with me and still carry that with me. My sons, three of my four sons, as a matter of fact, are diehard Rough Rider fans. The other one is not much of a sports guy, but appreciates what we do. So so grew up on the prairies and went to the University of Saskatchewan, got my degree there, moved over to Calgary, and got my my journalism and communications training at SAIT, and moved back to Saskatchewan for a few years and worked for the Archdiocese of Regina for about 3 years in the early 90s. And then just had the opportunity to work for a Catholic youth magazine called U Magazine. Prior to that was Veritas, from 1996, and spent a year there in Southern California with a great group of young Catholic professionals, and was a remarkable transition because it was at a point where my faith had really just blossomed thanks to an organization called CCO, Catholic Christian Outreach, which was founded at the University of Saskatchewan. Went on a retreat with them at a point where I was really at a hinge point in my faith. I was at a point where I was ready to make it my own, but I really had to really dig deep in and explore if it was true. And everything that I experienced with them and digging deeper into my faith, I came to believe that Jesus was who he said he was. And that was a reality, a very clear reality to me. And if that's true, then there are a lot of implications that I needed to explore. He came, he was a real man, he died, he rose from the dead, and he founded a church. And that's the Roman Catholic Church. And I dug deep into history, into theology, into philosophy. I tell people all the time, I'm not Catholic because I was raised Catholic. I'm Catholic because it's true. If it wasn't true, I would have left a long time ago. And when I accepted that as a 26, 27-year-old man, I began this amazing journey that took me from Regina to Southern California. I was there a year, went over to Massachusetts and worked for the National Shrine of Divine Mercy that's run by the Marians of the Immaculate Conception. I didn't know this when they hired me, but the Marians were very close to this guy named John Paul II, Karol Wojtyła. As a matter of fact, their superior general was a teacher with him back in the 50s at Catholic University of Lublin. So I'm meeting these Polish Catholic priests and learning their connection to John Paul II. And right around that time, I won a trip for two to Cancun. Now, what does that have to do with JP2? Well, I called the travel agent and I said, can I trade this in for a trip to Rome? And they said, yes. And my boss said, well, since you're going to be in Rome, I was 28 years old. They said, you might as well do some work for us and stay at our house there in Rome. I was single at the time. And oh, by the way, would you like to meet the Pope? And yeah, this is a mic drop moment where I'm like,
no kidding.
Yes. Yeah, sure. Okay. So that was December of 1996 when I won the trip. And over the course of the spring, these conversations are happening with my boss. And as it turns out, so the Marians had priests and brothers behind the Iron Curtain throughout the Soviet era in all of the Soviet bloc countries. And John Paul II said to them, I want you to lead the re-evangelization of Eastern Europe. Now, Providence found me in the midst of the Marians in Stockbridge. They published a magazine that went out to 250,000 people, that one of the biggest Catholic quarterly magazines still in existence in the United States. And I was their main news writer, and I'm going to Rome. And so they put me on a list. October 1st, 1997, I met John Paul II for the first time. It was a remarkable experience. I was also the webmaster of Marian.org, their website. So I printed out these pages from the website about Divine Mercy and John Paul II and his encyclical, Divas in Misericordia, and then Blessed Faustina, soon to be Saint Faustina. And I presented that to him in a leather folder, in color, very nicely bound, and explained all of my work to him. 60 seconds. I had 60 seconds with the greatest pope of the last 1,000 years. And he listened to me. He said, thank you. He put a rosary in my hand and he went to the next person. Pivotal moment in my life, because my whole life growing up, particularly in 1984, when JP2 toured Canada for the first time, for the only time, he came for World Youth Day in 2002. But in 1984, he toured Canada, and really, it was a pivotal moment in Canadian history too, because no Pope had ever set foot in Canada. He spent a week, was 10 days in Canada. And it was memorable for me as a 16-year-old kid to see the Pope in my own country, my humble little Canada. And then fast forward to 1997, just 13 years later. That's amazing. That's just 13 years later. And there I am in front of him.
Yeah, tell us about that 60 seconds, Patrick. What is that like? I mean, you get it. Does that seem like hours, or does it seem like it goes by in a half a second? I mean, you must have rerun those 60 seconds in your head many times.
So I was very anxious, nervous, because I went to Mass in his private chapel. There were in the papal apartments at the Vatican, right across the hall from his bedroom. And I came around the corner when his secretary led me into the chapel, came around the corner, and there he was. Like he was 20 feet from me, and he was kneeling in front of the tabernacle. And I swear that he glowed, this holy glow, but it might have just been the lights on his white vestments. But my heart literally jumped in my chest. And during the entire Mass, they vested him right in front of us. And then celebrated Mass. He didn't give a homily. He didn't distribute communion. But I had Holy Communion consecrated at the hands of John Paul II. And that was remarkable. I stared at him the whole time. I just wanted to absorb every second of this 25-minute Mass with the Holy Father. Then they led us out into an adjoining room. A few minutes later, he came in. But I was nervous, as I was saying, because I was the only one of those 30, 35 people that actually had a gift for him. So I'm preparing in my head what I'm going to say. I mean, I'm just a farm kid from Saskatchewan. I'm here in Rome with the Pope, for Pete's sake, right? It was a very, I'm not worthy, right? It was one of those I'm not worthy moments. But yet God deemed me worthy to bring me there. And so I'm working this through in my head, what I'm going to say, how I'm going to explain what I'm presenting him. And when he walked in the room, all of that anxiety was gone, just gone. And I was like about the fifth person that he came up to. And it was like standing next to my dad saying, hey, Dad, look what I did at work today. And it was that easy. It was that easy. People ask me all the time, you know, that he's has this reputation for having this aura of holiness about him. And I have to say, yes, it's true, particularly that first time, that first experience with him, because I'm not sure if we'll get into it all, but I had three private audiences with him. I was greeted by him twice in St. Peter's Square. So I had five encounters with John Paul II. And this was just the first one. The first one was very special. Just because of that moment I had with him. So yeah, I'm presenting with this. He puts that rosary in my hand, moves on to the next person. And yeah, I do relive those 60 seconds and what I said and how I explained it. But more I reflect on how he made me feel. People always say this too, that they're not going to remember what you said, but they'll remember how you made them feel. He made me feel special, because he gave me 60 seconds, a full minute of his day. And I had the honor, the privilege of being there with him for that moment. And he didn't have to do that. He's a busy guy. He's running the world in a sense as the universal pastor of the whole planet. So I was just touched. I was honored. And my brother was with me. My brother is still in Humboldt, Saskatchewan. He works for a community college there and has his own marketing business. He was with me. He was right next to me. And interestingly, I was in Massachusetts at the time, but Bishop Jevish, now Cardinal Jevish, introduced my brother. And he said, "This young man is from Canada." And the Pope says, "Oh, Canada." But he didn't finish the song.
That's something. That's so good. So interesting.
Sorry, that's just a joke. Just a little joke. But he did. He said, it's funny because I'm thinking this in my head. I think about people's words. The Pope really did say, "Oh, Canada." But he didn't finish the song.
He didn't keep going, eh?
Sorry.
Maybe he forgot that he had to sing some in French or something like that. He wasn't sure about that.
Yeah, probably.
But you know, I think it's important to highlight because who Pope John Paul II was to our generation, Patrick, like for the longest time, he was the only Pope I ever knew, you know, until Pope Benedict came around. And, you know, I was born in 1981. So until the time of his death, I mean, that was, you know, several decades. And then because I remember when the conclave came, it was just such a foreign thing to me. And here I was an adult in my 20s, but I was asking, you know, my mom and my dad, my family, so what happens in the conclave? You know,
yeah, and you know, I was 10 when John Paul was elected, mm-hmm. and I barely remember it. And then for 26 and a half years, I mean, I was married with children, and I couldn't remember a conclave. And interestingly, you know, since JP2 was elected, we've only had two conclaves, and we've only had one papal funeral since 1978. One pope has died since 1978.
They're a little extraordinary, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah, papal funeral is almost unprecedented, right?
And I think for people, because we have a lot of great listeners that are not Catholic, just great people of goodwill, Patrick, that listen to us. But when we talk about the Pope, we're talking about the office too, right? We're talking about the office of Peter and that lineage all the way back that we can trace our popes right back to St. Peter. And it's such mm-hmm. a beautiful thing. You've probably seen him too. There used to be a lot more common, but you'd see these big pictures and they'd have the picture or like a portrait painting or whatever of every pope, you know, throughout history right to the present. And I always loved that. I'd always just look at all these different names. But
those pictures are actually mosaics that are on the wall at St. Paul outside the walls in Rome.
Okay.
And every time a pope is elected, they create a new mosaic of the pope and they put it up on the wall. And yeah, you can buy these posters in Rome of all of the popes going back to Peter. And 266, I think we're up to now with Pope Francis. So yeah, it's a remarkable thing to be able to trace the leadership of the church. Now, Jesus Christ is the head of the Catholic Church. Let's be clear about that.
Yes.
The Pope is just his vicar. It's kind of his steward, the person he places in charge while he's away, but he's not really away. And so that for our non-Catholic and our Catholic listeners, we need to be very clear about that, that the Pope isn't the head of the church. He's just kind of the guy who's been given the keys to the kingdom until Jesus comes again. But, you know, that's why we pray for him, because he's not infallible unless he proclaims from the seat in it when it comes to faith and morals. But it's a remarkable history of our faith and our tradition.
And for Pope John Paul II, I mean, so there's the office of St. Peter, which he was obviously in the chair of, and then it's Karol Wojtyla, the man, like who he was. And, and he had such a, and I'm glad you mentioned just how, you know, the room just changed when he came close to you, right? And you know, how you changed. And I'd never met him personally, but I always felt like he knew me, that we were, there was a relationship there. When he spoke, it felt like he was speaking to me, and through his encyclicals, through his messages, through television. And the beautiful thing I find, you know, just with our church is that even though he's passed away, he's more real now than he was even back then, because there was the distance of an ocean between us. And he, even though he was the traveling Pope, which was awesome, again, just, highlighting the fact that the church goes to the people, not the other way around. It's always been that way. Sometimes I think we've kind of lost our way with that, right? Our expectation is that people go to the church, but it's the other way. It's always been the church coming to the people. And I thought, you know, him just traveling and his flying just really highlighted how important that was to him. But yeah, that connection, Patrick, to a generation, our generation and generations after, there's something really special, wasn't it, about him?
It really was. He had a natural charisma. And interestingly, when he was 9, his mother died. When he was about 12, his brother died. He had an older brother who was a doctor, died in a pandemic and epidemic. When he was in his early 20s, his father died. So he's 21, 22 years old. He just has started college, and his father died, leaving him essentially an orphan as a young man. And his friends were really shocked when he announced that he was going to become a priest. He was a very talented, very gifted actor, and they expected that this good-looking, talented, charismatic, athletic young man was going to conquer Poland on the stage. But it was right around the outbreak of the Second World War as well, when the Nazi tanks rolled into Krakow, and he had to take his studies for the priesthood underground. He was in a seminary with the Archbishop of Krakow, studying in secret. And so the formative years for him, because, you know, people think, oh, he lived in a palace, he traveled the world, he was very gifted, he must have had a great life and very privileged. But no, he had a lot of pain in his life. He was alone. He was hit by a truck, actually, when he was working in a chemical plant as a young man, and that injured his hip, and so he kind of had this hidden ailment. Even though he was very athletic, he still skied even as Pope, but he had a lot of pain in his physical body and his life that he carried with him as well. But he surrendered that to God. I think really think the genius of John Paul II was that he placed all of his talents at the service of the church. He laid them before God and said, you've given me these talents. They're all yours. Just I am your instrument, and just use me as you need me to be used. And when I've run the course of life, then, you know, I place myself and my soul in your hands. And ultimately, that example is applicable to each and every one of us. God has given each and every one of us amazing talents. You've started your podcast. I wrote my book. I'm doing public speaking across the United States on John Paul II. I kind of see my vocation as being a John Paul II megaphone, not letting people forget about him. But the secret really is to have a dedicated life of prayer and place our talents at the service of God, asking God to open the doors and show us how he wants to use us for his glory. Mother Teresa said this beautiful thing once. She said, I'm a small pencil in the hand of God, writing a love letter to the world. And what she meant by that was, I'm just this stubby old pencil. God is the one moving me and doing the work. I'm nothing. I'm going to be thrown away at the end and forgotten. She won't be, but that was her attitude, that all the good that she was able to accomplish was God's work using her. She surrendered. So it says humility. It says, I have talents, but I'm putting them in God's hands to use me for whatever he wants to use me for. And I really think that's the secret to holiness is, first of all, we're nothing without prayer. If we're not connected to God through our prayer, through our complete devotion to him, then there's not much God can do with us. But that with that comes the surrender that Lord, as you will, not as I will. As St. John the Baptist said, I must decrease, he must increase. If we do that, we're going to see miracles in our lives every day.
The connection with the Slavic people, Patrick, I mean, you and I both have our backgrounds and our ancestors that's where we came from. Right. And is from my dad, he was born and raised in Czechoslovakia and during the time of World War II. So he was, unlucky. I don't even know what the right word is to describe it, but he, you know, lived through first the Nazi invasion and them taking over Czechoslovakia, similarly to Poland as well, but also the misfortune of having the Soviets and Russians so-called liberate Czechoslovakia and the oppression that the church was under from both of those brutal and diabolical regimes. What did it mean for the Slavic people to have, you know, Karol Wojtyla coming from, you know, what the world has always looked at a country like Poland as the poor people, the Poles, you know, the Ukrainians, the Slavics, you know, these poor people here that, what do they really contribute to the world? You know, and we still go through that today. We still see that kind of unfortunate bias against Slavic people. But yeah, what did it mean for the Slavic people? I mean, I could speak for myself too on this, but Patrick, but I'm sure you have some insights on this. But for him to come forth in 1978 when he became Pope, what did that mean to the Slavic people?
Well, let me preface by this, that I grew up hearing Ukrainian jokes and Polish jokes all the time, even though, interestingly, I'm mostly German blood, I have a significant amount of Polish blood, including my last name, and my ancestors left what's now northern Poland 200 years ago and went to what's now southern Ukraine. And they were there until 1904 before they came to Saskatchewan. So my roots are in Poland, in eastern Germany, and transition through Russia/Ukraine. So I feel very connected to that part of the world. I've traveled to that part of the world. I've been to Ukraine twice, Poland four times, and it was absolutely transformational for Poland to be elevated. To have this highly respected individual come from Poland at a time where it was one of the most oppressed countries in the world as part of the Soviet regime. And today, I mean, he's absolutely revered as a Pole, as a human person. He's a national hero. And will always be a national hero to the Polish people, and as you said, he's not just a Pole; he's a Slav, and all of the Slavic countries truly revere him, no matter if they're Catholic or not. I mean, he had tremendous amount of dignity. He spoke a dozen languages fluently. He traveled to 140 countries around the world. Add up his air miles, it's like the equivalent of going to the moon and back twice. So, you know, he really did live the gospel and preach the gospel. He was seen live by more people than any human being who ever lived by a long stretch. I mean, you might say, well, Billy Graham was 50 years, but John Paul II drew 7 million people to the close of World Youth Day in Manila. It would take Billy Graham 10 years to draw 7 million people to the stadiums he did.
I think that 7 million people, Patrick, I think that was one of the largest gatherings in human history, I believe,
human
right?
Human history, yeah. Yes, absolutely. So what did it mean to the people? It was everything. It was everything. And, you know, Providence, and this is just the thing too, that it, again, going back to John Paul II surrendering all of his gifts and talents to God for the use of the church and for the glory of our Lord, God plucked him out of history placed him in history at that moment where history needed him, where the church needed him, where the world needed him during the oppressive time of the Soviet Union, and collaborated with Ronald Reagan to bring down the Iron Curtain without a shot being fired. Yeah, I tell this story all the time that in 1979, June of 79, John Paul went back to Poland for the first time as Pope. He was elected in the fall of 78. Went back to Poland, and Ronald Reagan was at his ranch in California watching the news coverage of this. And for some of your listeners will know this, that Fulton Sheen and Ronald Reagan were the two stalwarts preaching against the evils of communism in the United States through the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And well, not so much Sheen in the 80s, Reagan, because Sheen died in 79. But Reagan saw this. He was preparing for the Republican National Convention. He was not yet nominated as the presidential candidate for the Republican Party. But he watched this coverage, and he jumped up out of his chair, and he said, "The Pope is the key." He said that out loud. And his aides are looking at him like, "What? What's that, Mr. Reagan? The Pope is the key to bringing down the Soviet Union. Look what he's doing. He went into the lion's den. He is there. He is changing the world by this visit to Poland. Millions of Poles came out to see him. The Soviet Empire could not control the message. They tried. They failed. Millions more saw him on TV. There was something awakened in the Polish people after 30, 40 years of this oppressive regime. And Reagan saw that. So one of the first things Reagan did when he's elected president in the fall of 1980 was early 81, he appointed the first ambassador to the Vatican, to the Holy See, and established diplomatic relations with John Paul II and the Vatican. Now, people may not know this too, that the Holy See is the city-state of the Vatican. It's actually the smallest nation on earth. And the Pope is the sovereign of that nation. So the Pope isn't just a spiritual leader, but he's also a temporal leader. And they have status at the UN as a nation, the Holy See does. So Reagan established these diplomatic relations with the Holy See, and they shared a tremendous amount of intelligence back and forth through the 80s. And not long later, basically 10 years after John Paul II went to Poland in June of 79, the Iron Curtain fell. November of 1989 is when the Berlin Wall came down. So in those 10 years was Reagan and John Paul II collaborating their messaging, the intelligence they shared with one another. A lot of what the U.S. shared with John Paul II, he used that information to craft his speeches, his diplomacy, his visits to other countries, and his diplomats lobbying other countries with sanctions and all that kind of stuff. And it had a tremendous impact, and it changed the world.
I think one of the greatest moments captured on television, a massive victory for Christendom and Catholicism and just for all people of goodwill, which was that the papal visit in 1979, was it, Patrick, when the Polish people were chanting, "We want God, we want God"?
That was it.
That was the one.
That was it.
I'm going to post that in the show notes, and I want people to see that. It is one of the most powerful moments you could ever see on television. If you understand the oppression that these Polish people were going through for decades and decades and decades, and in the face of the communists that were obviously probably infiltrating the crowd, probably all, really not even infiltrating, they're probably in plain view. And when you see the video, you'll see Pope John Paul II just have just look up and pause and just let the moment of these people's chants. I'm getting emotional talking about it. It was beautiful, though, wasn't it, Patrick?
John Paul II's theater background really helped him. People said that when he became Pope, he knew how to be the Pope already. He had been an instrumental figure in the Second Vatican Council as a young bishop, and he studied in Rome. He knew Italian fluently. He knew the world. He had traveled the world already before he was elected Pope. And that moment in 1979, when he's standing on the stage, and people start chanting during his homily, over a million people chanting, "We want God." He just stopped speaking, let them say what they had to say, and allow the Holy Spirit to work. He also, in a beautiful moment, called down the Holy Spirit on his country. That was a powerful moment. And I'm getting teared up here too, because I saw this happen, and not in person, but in the video. There's actually a documentary I want to recommend for everyone. It's called 9 Days That Changed the World. Newt Gingrich produced it about 10 years ago, about this visit that John Paul made to Poland in 79. And it really was pivotal. And he unpacks it in a beautiful way. He pulls in footage and experts who experience that, but footage that had never been seen before. And you really see what a pivotal moment in history this was. That I grew up in Saskatchewan, expecting that one day these nuclear bombs are going to fly over my head. And of course, they go over the North Pole, right? Russia fires it over the pole toward the United States. It's the shortest path. They're not going to go over Europe. They're going to shoot it over the pole. America is going to respond by shooting another nuke over the pole, and they're going to land on my head.
That's poor Canadians. Yeah.
I know, right? Like, we're gonna get it. Maybe Northwest Territories, but Canada's gonna get the fallout from this. That was in the back of my mind growing up. So just to know that this happened the way it did, the evil empire, as it was called, fell without a shot being fired, was truly a miracle. And John Paul II instrumental in making that happen.
Just thinking of this right now, I know that obviously JP too had just an amazing devotion to the Blessed Virgin Mary. What was his, I guess, relationship or devotion to Fatima and Our Lady of Fatima and that message of Fatima? And I just keep thinking of the errors of Russia will spread throughout the world. Is there any connection there, Patrick, that can be shared, I guess, and how
this could be a whole show. It could be a whole show. So
should we do part two another time then?
Yeah. Well, I'll get into it a little bit. I mean,
yeah.
John Paul was a boy when his mother died, and his father essentially said, "Now Our Lady is your mother." And if you've ever been to Poland, they're so devoted to Our Lady. The Black Madonna, Our Lady of Częstochowa, is at the shrine at Jasna Góra. John Paul II went there as a young boy. He went there as a young man. He went there as a priest. He had made regular pilgrimages there, even as Pope. I think he visited there three times as Pope. And one time he said, "How many times have I come here and poured out my heart to you, my mother?" And he said that's where he formed his motto, "Totus Tuus," completely yours. He was so devoted to Our Lady. And that is very common for Polish people. They fly to the Mother of God for begging her intercession for their every need. And you know, through her intercession, God answers. So interestingly, I think John Paul II always had a fascination with Fatima and a devotion. But when he was shot on May 13th, 1981, in St. Peter's Square, he was recovering in the hospital. He asked for two things. He asked for St. Faustina's diary. She was not even Blessed Faustina then. He asked for Faustina's diary. He also asked for the third secret of Fatima. Now, I always find this fascinating. You know, if I was elected president of the United States, I would want to say, bring me all the papers on Area 51. Bring me all the JFK assassination documents. I want to read them. If I was elected Pope, I'd say, bring me all the secret stuff on Fatima. I want that day one. I want to find out, right?
Yeah.
So he hadn't even looked at the third secret of Fatima. Mm. And so he's reading these things as he's recovering, and he's pondering them and praying on them. And then, of course, he meets with Sister Lucia, who was still alive at the time, the last seer of the Fatima children. And in their conversations, he asks if this assassination attempt fulfills the third secret. She said yes. So there are still people out there who say, oh, there's some more to the third secret. You know, when Sister Lucia and John Paul II, two very holy people, say, folks, that's all there is, you just got to believe them, right? So, but yeah, so getting back to Russia, you know, one thing Our Lady said was that if Russia isn't consecrated to my Immaculate Heart, that Russia will spread her errors around the world. So there had been previous attempts to consecrate Russia to the Immaculate Heart. John Paul II did twice. And the first time apparently wasn't quite right. He did it the second time. And Sister Lucia, again, she said that fulfills what Our Lady requested. Now, there are people still who say, but it hasn't properly been consecrated. Well, listen, you got a saint and a soon-to-be saint who said that it was done right. So come on, give him a break and just go with it, right? So And the errors that still the errors of Marxism are still alive and well in the world, but in some ways Russia is actually more Christian than the culture that's coming out of our country, Canada, yes, and the United States. So there are things that they're getting right and errors that our nations are spreading. There are four countries that have unlimited abortion, that have no laws governing abortion. North Korea, fully communist. China, fully communist. Canada and the United States. Canada and the U.S. should have nothing in common with communist North Korea and communist China. But we do in that regard. So, you know, we're exporting, as Americans, we're exporting abortion around the world, paying countries in Africa to have abortion policies. Now, thankfully, most African countries are saying, I want nothing to do with this because it's so against our culture, thankfully. So there are still errors that are emanating that need to be clarified and rectified and put to bed. And so, but yes, Fatima was very close to John Paul II's heart. And matter of fact, interestingly too, Fatima was very close to Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. He was Protestant, but he understood Fatima. He had a lot of Catholics in his cabinet. And because of John Paul II and a lot of the things going on, he asked to be briefed on Fatima. So he understood the spiritual dimension of the Cold War, that it was not just a temporal thing, but it was a spiritual battle. And he was very cognizant of that.
What if scenarios are something that's a temptation for all of us? I've often thought, what would JP2 think of this present world? What would it be like if he was here right now, traveling around, speaking against these evil forces in the world? But to your point, Patrick, I think that makes perfect sense, is that he was a saint for his time, and the Lord sent him for that time. But you know, the influence of his life still reverberates through the world today and through the church. And if we allow it, but what would you think of how would Pope John Paul II, Saint John Paul II, how would he look at our present world right now? We talk about the errors of Russia from Fatima, and he can't help but say it's not Russia, but it's an ideology we're talking about, and that would be one of Marxism.
I think he would be writing encyclicals and letters on Marxism and its errors. John Paul II was very fixated on the human person, understanding the human person as a unique, unrepeatable individual made in the image of the likeness of God. You know, people need to understand that all of creation is for the human person. The human person is for God. The only thing God made for himself is the human person. We are made in his image and likeness, but we're also destined to be with him forever. That's his desire for each human person. He gave us free will, so we can choose that, or we can choose something else, which is not him. But our eternal destiny is either heaven or hell. We choose it. We're allowed to choose it, but all of creation is for us. So I think he would be doubling down on his teaching on the human person, on the errors of Marxism, and how in Marxism, people are just cogs in the wheel to serve the state. That's all we are. We're just tools. Now, I also think that he would be calling for prayer and fasting and essentially doing a John the Baptist. And the Lord is near. The kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe the good news. I think that he would be really focused on that as well. And I think that would be his message. Not a whole lot different than it was then, but I think that would be his focus now.
Yeah, I keep thinking of this. It's not the Chinese people; it's the Chinese Communist Party, and
exactly
what's been unleashed on this world. And I think that you know, it's actually one of the few bright spots I found here in the last couple months, is that these evils of this regime, you know, masquerading as something like a real government when we're talking about a bunch of gangsters, Patrick.
Absolutely.
It's not just to the world that they're doing this harm, but also to their own people, you know.
Sure.
My understanding is there's 100 million people that belong to the Chinese Communist Party that do very little very little when it comes to work, and they live very high on the hog, if I may. And the rest of the people live under almost like a slavery-like condition. Now we've got this virus that's come to this world, has come to North America, Europe, to the West. And, you know, in pure Marxist fashion, it divides everybody internally, especially here in Canada, the United States. Everybody's looking to point fingers at each other when, I don't know, it doesn't seem like we're pointing the finger in the right direction.
Absolutely.
Where do you come out on all this, Patrick, this whole virus thing?
I think we're called to live our lives without fear. One of the hallmarks of John Paul II's papacy was be not afraid. Be not afraid. Now, his be not afraid was don't be afraid to let Christ into your heart. Don't be afraid to let God transform you and use you for his glory, because it will be the best thing that ever happened to you. People often think of religious people as being slaves or being living in drudgery or being miserable. But, you know, when Christ fills your heart, it's the best thing that could ever happen to you, because the best thing for a person is to be an adopted son or daughter of God. It's absolutely transformational. It's filled with joy. It's soaked in joy. So the be not afraid. I've made it a very conscious decision that I'm not going to be afraid of a virus. I'm not going to be afraid of getting sick. I'm not going to be afraid of dying. Now, at the same time, I'm not going to live my life foolishly and storm into a lab and drink down the virus. That's just pure foolishness. So prudence and fearlessness. Fearlessness in living my faith in a dynamic way, and fearlessness in just going out into the world boldly and proclaiming the truth. And it's becoming in short supply. It's becoming a rare thing for people to live their lives that way. The early Christian community lived that way, and it changed the Roman Empire because of the way they treated each other, because of the way they lived their lives, markedly different from what people were used to. In ancient Rome, people were very paganistic. They had their gods. They served the state. They paid homage to their gods, which I think in their back of their minds knew was just foolishness, but it was the tradition that they had, so they followed it. But these Christians lived differently. They treated each other with respect and with dignity, and we can't lose sight of that. I think too many Christians are living their lives acting in a petty way or treating each other and demeaning one another. We can't do that. I posted something on Facebook, and I sometimes do this without really thinking it through. And one of my friends, a brother Christian, pointed out that my meme that I posted was not Christian. It was demeaning. And, you know, I thanked him for that, because it's easy to get swept up in the age, in the way the world is going, and being petty and demeaning to other people and not respecting people, even if we disagree with them. So I think we need to remind ourselves and remind each other that we need to live differently. We need to sound different. We need to act different. And that has to be led with love. But we can't do that by ourselves without prayer, all of this good stuff that we know is right can't come out from us unless we receive it first. And we do that through prayer and the sacraments.
St. Charles Borromeo lived through an actual plague back hundreds of years ago. And he's been credited with this quote that said, fear the plague of the soul versus the contagion of the body.
Mm.
And I've thought often about that many times in the last year or two, but our church is... What the reaction that we've had, have we really been providing that leadership to this world, that spiritual leadership? Because St. Charles Borromeo, while he did have, there was a lot of precautionary, you know, making sure that people weren't spreading the contagion of the virus of that, the pandemic at the time. But he still kept the churches open for the most part. There was catechesis on street corners outdoors. Inside of churches, if you wanted to bless yourself with holy water, there would be one for those who felt like they were sick, and there were some that felt they were okay. He put a high premium on sacramentals, on catechesis, and on the sacraments.
I'm glad you brought up the sacraments. I mean, that is our rocket fuel for holiness. You know, the world, the flesh, and the devil are going to eat us up. The only thing that's going to be our life preserver in this storm of life is the sacraments, particularly confession and Holy Communion. That has to, the bread of life and the sacrament of reconciliation. Without them, we can't survive this storm. We just can't.
Let's talk about that book really quick. I'm sure we've already kind of delved into a lot of the content of that book, but maybe the process itself and why you picked the title and maybe some of the background of why you wrote that book.
Yeah, so I started writing in 2019 because I realized that May of 2020 was going to be John Paul II's 100th birthday. So I wrote it in the fall of 2019 and was published last year in 2020 for his 100th birthday. And why I wrote it? I wrote it just because I felt it welling up in me. I'd been giving talks about how John Paul II changed the world, about how I met him. But I really started to see that my teenage kids had no experience of John Paul II. They were born after he died. They're starting to graduate high school. We've got people in college who have no memory of John Paul II, high school graduates who have no memory of John Paul II. So I wrote it particularly for them, so that they can kind of get, this is kind of a primer on John Paul II. Each of these 100 ways is a page to 2 pages max on 100 ways he changed the world. So it's an easy read, but it's really in depth at the same time. And at my secondary audience is us, people that grew up with JP2. So when in the process of writing the book, I realized that I missed so much of what he did. His impact was, what had the depth and the breadth of his impact was amazing. 26 and a half years on the world stage, he used every day to the max. I mean, it's truly, someone to do what he did, it would take like 10 lifetimes for most people, but he was relentless in his commitment to the papacy and to his work and to the salvation of souls. Here's a giveaway. The number one thing that he did to change the world, the new evangelization. He understood that the church exists to evangelize. That's its sole purpose. And he put a re-emphasis on bringing people into right relationship with Jesus Christ. He said, the new evangelization needs to be new in methods and ardor. Ardor meaning passion and new methods. And we need to find new methods like podcasts to communicate the gospel, to communicate the truths of the faith. And we need to do it with zeal and with joy and with love. And that was really, that encapsulated his papacy. That and having a proper understanding of the human person, as I said before.
100 ways that John Paul II changed the world is the name of the book. We'll make sure we have all kinds of links on there in the show notes. Before we let you go, Patrick, tell us about Nova Media, what you're up to right now, and how people can get a hold of you and follow you online.
Yeah, so people can get my book, get a signed copy of my book at booksbypatrick.com. It's actually patricknowakoski.com, but nobody can spell that. So booksbypatrick.com will take you to that page. You can buy an autographed copy of my book. It's available at amazon.ca, amazon.com, and our Sunday Visitor bookstore. Nova Media. So I started doing my first job out of college. I was working for the Archdiocese of Regina, doing PR for the Archdiocese. And God kind of had me as a journalist and as a PR guy. So this is my PR hat. And so what I do is I help Catholic organizations, nonprofit, for-profit, individuals, doesn't matter. If you're Catholic and you want to reach a broader audience, that's what I help people with. One of my newest clients was a 94-year-old Monsignor from the Bronx who wrote a biography. He served 6 popes, and he's the last surviving member of Fulton Sheen's household. He lived with Fulton Sheen in Manhattan.
Wow. Interesting.
During the 50s. And so I helped promote his memoir, and it was a fascinating experience working with this holy priest to promote his book. But I've worked with profits, nonprofits as well, fundraising, just a whole host of different organizations. That website is CatholicPublicist.com.
Outstanding. So good, Patrick. Well, you know what? And now that the whole world knows you are a Canadian, you're from Saskatchewan, you got an open invitation to come on this podcast anytime. Thank you for your insights, your stories. It feels like we're just scratching the surface of Pope John Paul II and what we're up against in this life. But yeah, God bless you for what you're doing, Patrick. And I look forward to chatting with you again sometime in the future.
We'll do it again soon, David.
Well, big thanks again to Patrick Nowakowski for joining us. And that book, again, it's called 100 Ways John Paul II Changed the World. And that's available on all kinds of different platforms, whether that's through Amazon or through Patrick's website. Also, knock on the door of your Catholic bookstore in your area and ask for them to bring the book in. It's a great read. Highly recommend it. And thanks again to Patrick for sharing his insights with us. And the Catholic Connect podcast is on Twitter, on Facebook. Follow us, subscribe as you see fit. And drop us a review on Spotify, Apple, Google, wherever you find your fine podcasts. It helps us get our message out, this message of love from the church, from Jesus Christ. And indeed, Jesus Christ on the cross, he's all we need. That should be enough for us. Let's base our life on the sacraments, especially that of the Eucharist, receiving it worthily, and also going to confession. And we know how often we got to go. We got to go every Lent, every Advent, and anytime you're in a state of mortal sin. Don't even spend a second of your life there. Thanks for listening to the podcast, everyone. God bless. We'll chat with you very soon.